You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold and all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I am Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. Across the table from me, with the slight schwitz of a midtown sprint, it's Neil Payne. Hello, Neil.
Hey, how's it going, Chad?
And across the country, not all the way across.
Half of the country.
Halfway across the country, it's Kate Fagan. Hello, Kate.
Hi, Chad.
Hi, Kate of ESPNW fame, of course. Guys, a lot of sports happening out there.
There was a lot of it. Did you guys both stay up all night to watch that game?
The Thunder game?
Yes.
It was, can I confess something to you guys? It was the only Thunder Warriors game I stayed up all night to watch.
Okay, so it was the first of the seven games where you actually watched all of it.
Yeah, I've been faking it this whole time. Did you hit the hay? Is that what you're
doing? No, I watched the first half on TV and the second half I streamed it on the app from bed. But I was committed. I watched the whole thing.
I think it was worth watching. We'll get into it. So today we're going to talk about, of course, the NBA Finals, which are coming, and what happened at the end of that Thunder Warriors series breakdown, sort of whether it was – I feel like I ask the same question every time. Did the Warriors win or did the Thunder lose? Then we will revisit our conversation about African Americans and analytics from last week, this time with Chris Herring, our sports reporter for the Wall Street Journal. We'll talk with Chris about ways to make analytics more inclusive and whether the divide between white and black fans was as deep as Mike Wilbon made it out to be. And then hockey, the Stanley Cup Finals have begun, which means it's time to say the words Corsi and Fenwick over and over again. The Washington Post's Neil Greenberg will join us to talk Penguin Sharks and whether there's anything to learn about California becoming a hockey hotbed over the last few years. All right, on to the NBA Finals. The Warriors have done it. They've beaten the Thunder. How do they do it? Here's Stephen A. Smith to explain.
The MVP showed up and he was a man amongst boys. Steph Curry put on an absolute show, scoring 24 points in the second half. He was absolutely unstoppable. And I told y'all before the game, it was going to be the men who showed up and boys were going to get exposed. We know who the boys are. It ain't on Golden State. Sean Livingston scoring points. Harrison Barnes scoring a couple of points. Iguodala hits a three. Klay Thompson hits six threes. Steph Curry hits seven threes. I mean, my God, you're looking at all of these guys do all of these things. And Oklahoma City's answer with all that talent was, here, Kevin Durant. Here, Russell Westbrook. Save us. And they couldn't do it.
Wow. Yeah,
the Western Conference Finals, they're just a referendum on masculinity. That's really what sports is all about.
So Iguodala is more of a man because he hit that 1-3 from like the right wing than anybody on the Oklahoma City Thunder.
Correct.
I guess.
No matter how many threes they hit. That's of course.
Okay. I got
of course.
It.
So I do think worth discussing before we get to Curry is whether Westbrook and Durant weren't enough, as Stephen A. Smith is suggesting, because it seemed like there were a whole lot in the games Thunder were winning for sure, and then last night, well, I want to get your guys' thoughts before I get to how the game ended.
My initial thought was when we were talking last week, it was like, how does a 55-win regular season team close the gap on a 73-win team? And Neil, you correctly pointed out, like, there's just that huge gap that they're playing up to. And instead of now looking at it through the lens of, wow, the Thunder really tanked and they choked, it more so seemed like maybe they just played like the team they actually were all along in the final three games.
Yeah, but that's probably true to some extent or another. Like I don't know, it's so tough because they are a really good offensive team and they did not play like a good offensive team down the stretch of those two kind of games in which they had opportunities and they put them away. And I feel like that is kind of our instinctual, well, not ours, but certain individuals from an older form of media, the impulse is whenever that happens to kind of try to explain it using these cliched things like men versus boys and things like that. I mean, no doubt that it's a very tough loss for the Thunder. There's no two ways around it. Like Andrew Flowers, our colleague here at 538, and I did a thing where we looked at basically your probability of winning the series at after each quarter. And going into the fourth quarter of Game 6, the Thunder had a 96% chance of winning the series and going to the
finals.
That
includes their chance of winning Game 7 and closing it out in Game 7.
Yeah, so that was their that was the second biggest blown, you know, conference championship ever, or at least since 1984, the advent of the 16-team era. The only one bigger was the 2000 Blazers, when they blew it to the Lakers. So we are talking about, you know, kind of historical territory with that. And it should also be pointed out that the Thunder actually outscored Golden State in the series as a whole, if you add up all the kind of competing blowouts and all of that over the whole series. So I think all of those things kind of come together for that. But at the same time, yeah, maybe, you know, the Warriors played like, maybe it was more of a case of them playing like the team they played like all season long, and the Thunder kind of getting cold at the worst possible time. And that combination, we talk about often, these lines crossing of probability, that was enough to put the Warriors over the top, even though their odds were pretty low at various points in the series.
But Neil, when you say that there was a 96% chance for the Oklahoma City Thunder to win the whole series going into the fourth quarter of Game 6, does that just account for the Thunder's performance within that specific series? And perhaps then we saw like kind of an artificial spike in the Oklahoma City Thunder because they played out of their minds for a stretch? Or does it account for the baseline of like who they proved to be throughout the year?
Yeah, I think that's kind of both true, and I'm not totally sure, because we use the ELO rating, which is, of course, 538's kind of pet metric to try to figure out how good a team is. And that actually does give you more credit for wins and losses and performance more recently. So in the case of the ELO over the past week, especially when the Thunder were up 3-1, they had a higher ELO rating than the Warriors did. According to that power rating, which does try to pinpoint how good you are right now instead of saying, you know, we're just looking at the regular season or we're just looking at the, you know, year-long track record and kind of weighing game one equally to game 100 of the season, they thought that the Thunder were a slightly better team, or at worst equals to the 73-win Warriors. So it could be that they were getting overrated and maybe the Warriors and Thunder were who we thought they were, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I don't know, that approach usually tends to be pretty accurate. Like if a team starts playing better, for instance, the 2001 Lakers come to mind, they didn't have a very good regular season, but the way in which they played throughout the playoffs, by the time they were playing against the Spurs in the conference championship and even beyond going on to face the Sixers in the finals, they had played up to this level that power rating considered them to be one of the best playoff teams ever.
I also want to talk a bit about fatigue, because it did seem at the end of that game last night that Westbrook and Durant were just toast. That they were just totally had run. They both of them played more minutes last night than any of the Warriors did. And it did seem to me as though the lineups were a bit shallower on the Thunder than they were on the Warriors' end of things. And so I'm wondering sort of whether their usage rate, Neil, was particularly high compared to norms, or am I just totally making this up out of thin air?
Well, those two players are kind of historic already in terms of their combination of usage rates. Like Westbrook almost broke the all-time record for usage last year, and Durant, now that he was healthy the whole year, was also, you know, right there with him in the 30% usage. And then also Durant played 41.3 minutes per game in the series, and Westbrook played 39.1. So yeah, by that combination of high usage and high minutes played, this has to be one of the highest workloads put on two guys on a team, you know, in recent memory, or one of the highest at least.
And then another thing, I'm not sure if you have metrics to put to it, Neil, but that seemed to happen as I watched Game 7 was like first, probably through three quarters, it seemed like Durant's actual touches, or definitely his shots, but it seemed like his involvement in the offense was smaller than I expected it to be through three quarters, as Westbrook kind of ran things, a lot of pick and rolls up top that didn't necessarily work through Kevin Durant. And then sort of at the end in the fourth quarter, it was like, ruh-roh, like we really can't generate any offense. We got to go through KD more. And then all of a sudden at the end, it was like spinning back to him way more to be like, hero ball, okay, we got to give it to our guy and see if he can do things. That was my gut reaction as a human watching it. Did it seem like that to you? And was there any necessarily usage rate numbers through like the first half that showed that KD was being used not at the levels we might expect?
Yeah, it definitely seemed that way to me, and for the second straight game, too, that was kind of the way that it was going. I don't have the numbers specifically to back it up, but it wouldn't surprise me if they really did try to put everything on those two guys yet again at the end of the game, and it just didn't go right for them. And I feel like shot selection was kind of an interesting thing for Oklahoma City throughout the entire series, because they conversely, you know, at various times they made pretty much everything that they threw up at the basket, and then later in the series they ended up missing kind of some of the same shots. Like, you know, they always talk about it being a make or miss league, and that sounds trite sometimes, but given what we know about the volatility of your performance of making shots, even after controlling for where you take them from, you know, maybe we were kind of too high on Oklahoma City at varying points in the middle of the series, because they were just knocking down everything, and even, you know, in the early stages of some of these other games, and then maybe they just regressed to the mean.
So I want to go to Steph Curry now. Before game six, I want to say, maybe before game seven, our colleague at 538, Ben Morris, wrote that Stephen Curry's shot just hadn't quite come back since he'd come back from injury, basically, that one of the hallmarks of Curry is just how much better he is than the expectation, given the shots that he's taking, and at some at his high point this year was scoring 0.64 more points per shot than was expected given the shot, and as of the playoffs he was down to 0.08 coming off the injury, and yet now it seems as though things are things better. Were you seeing the Steph Curry that you expected to see, you guys, last night?
Certainly down the stretch of that game, right, Kate?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was maybe, well, the game six and then definitely game seven was, to me, the first time since Steph was injured where the degree of difficulty, quick release when, like, a bigger guy, when Adams was guarding him, or sometimes Durant, the kinds of stuff we started to expect to see throughout the year, we started to see from Curry again that had been maybe a couple weeks coming. That was my reaction from watching it. But it also speaks to our ridiculous expectations of Curry that even going into Game 7, definitely more so Game 6, we were saying, oh, Steph Curry has had a down series. Is he playing injured? And there were a lot of interesting conversations around that. And now that the series is over and you actually look back on his production, it's like at an almost like an all-time kind of performance level from long range.
Yeah. Oh, completely. Yeah, aside from that overtime that he had against the Blazers, where he kind of did some of the same things, it really hadn't been the same level of Curry shooting that we had seen during the whole season and during the playoffs last year. So this particular game, he shot, I want to say, let's see if I have this right. So his effective field goal percentage, which is a measure of your efficiency, that only kind of looks like a percentage. I think Mike Wilbon actually kind of called that out last week during his thing where he was talking about percentages that go over 100. This is one of those where it just is like points per shot, but scaled to look like field goal percentage. Curry shot 41 percentage points higher than you would expect based on where he took shots from during the game last night. So I think that was by far one of his highest performances of the playoffs.
Okay, let's look forward just a bit to the actual finals now that the Western Conference Finals are over. And let's refresh ourselves on what happened last year, which was that at one point the Cavs were up on the Warriors. I feel like after the coronation there was some reprogramming where
Delhi.
We just thought, yeah, where we just thought the Warriors had it all along. But indeed, Matthew Dellavedova was the name on the country's lips for a little bit. The Warriors eventually closed out the series, but importantly, the Cavs did not have Kevin Love nor Kyrie Irving in last year's finals, nor Channing Frye, who they will have this year, who's a midseason pickup. So is this going to be a different finals than we saw last year?
It has to be a different finals, absolutely, from what we saw last year, just because if you take what LeBron said after four games in the Eastern Conference Finals, and he's like, we don't feel like we've faced adversity yet in the postseason. Even being tied 2-2 didn't necessarily feel like adversity because they hadn't even had to shift out of second gear yet. And they were like, well, look, we got third gear, we got fourth gear, we got fifth gear, so we haven't hit adversity yet. Now you go back to last year and what we watched in the NBA Finals, and like that whole series had to, out of necessity based on injury by LeBron, be played at like redlining gear, like highest gear possible. So to me, this is a very different series because you actually have a Cavs team that is healthy and knows it has up to however many gears, and it'll be interesting to see how they shift between them and when they need to and how they exploit certain guys, whether it's Love at various times or Kyrie versus LeBron taking fewer shots. It just seems now like you've got a Cavs team that's coming in with more options rather than just LeBron at red line.
Well, and importantly, it seems as though if LeBron's not being covered well, if he is being covered well, or if his shot's not going down, there are alternative paths to still win. You know, that was not necessarily the case last year. And so it means that if you're thinking probabilistically, let's say LeBron's having an off night, that doesn't doom the whole team the way it maybe did last year.
And it hasn't yet in the playoffs, right, at certain points when he hasn't played up to whatever sky high expectations we have. Like, the Cavaliers can still win games, and whether or not you think that's because of the competition is one thing, and obviously the Warriors are completely different from what the Cavs have seen so far.
Yeah, and during the finals last year, the Cavs were stealing games because of Dellavedova, because of Timofey Mozgov. Like, I don't know how sustainable that kind of plan necessarily would have been, and certainly they looked a little overmatched as the series went on, and the Warriors kind of made their famous adjustment and forced them to kind of contend with the small ball lineup. But now, just looking at it, and like you said, Kate, the talent on Cleveland now compared to last year seems like an immense advantage to this year's team. You know, Kyrie and Kevin Love alone, especially Kevin Love finding more of a place within this team than he seemed to have definitely last year, and even, you know, to a certain degree early this season when he was kind of working his way into what this team was like and after they fired David Blatt. So, I have to think that this is not a rematch in the same sense as those 80s rematches where you would see, you know, Lakers and Celtics and it was pretty much the same teams kind of coming together again. This is a very different matchup, and I'm not sure if it's more akin to, you know, we saw matchups where it was like Celtics versus Lakers again in 2010 versus 2008, and that was a very different matchup than it had been just a few years earlier. So it's probably going to be akin to that this year, where what you learned about the teams in the previous incarnation may not actually carry over as much to this version.
Okay, I think we have to leave there because Joe is frantically waving his arms from the booth just over instant message. But before we totally move on, let's just note that 538 is predicting the Warriors have a 69% chance of defeating the Cleveland Cavaliers in the finals. And ESPN's Basketball Power Index, a different kind of metric, has a 75% Warriors favorite. So looking like more often than not, Golden State back-to-back champs. And now a word from Hot Takedown sponsor, SeatGeek. Have you ever been frustrated trying to buy tickets online? Most sites make it complicated and then try to sneak in huge fees at checkout. That's why you need to try SeatGeek. They've made it easier than ever to buy and sell sports and concert tickets. Let's say you want to go to a sporting event. Let's say you want to go to the Stanley Cup Finals. You want to see Joe Pavelski, that star. Maybe as good as Alex Ovechkin. Let's say you want to go see a San Jose Sharks game. You don't want to, you know, try and compete with all that Silicon Valley money. You just want to get a good deal. Well, good thing the SeatGeek has a deal score in its website. That deal score will tell you whether or not you're getting a good deal no matter where it is in the stadium. I personally don't buy tickets for below a 99 deal score. You want me to come to the game with you? Give me a 99 deal score. I don't care how much I have to pay. Just the satisfaction of having that kind of deal is what I'm after. SeatGeek pulls all the tickets available on other sites into one place so you can save time and never miss a deal. You can also set alerts for upcoming games so that you can know when that 99 deal score is out there and go snatch it up. Most importantly, you get a $20 rebate off your first SeatGeek purchase. To do that, download the free SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab, click add a promo code, enter promo code TAKEDOWN, as in Hot Takedown. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you made your first ticket purchase. Again, a free $20. All you have to do is buy a ticket. Download the free SeatGeek app and enter promo code TAKEDOWN today. Last week, Neil and I talked to Michael Wilbon about his new article for TheUndefeated.com, which argued that African Americans are not interested in analytics or talking about analytics when they talk about sports. I've been thinking a lot about that conversation all week, which I think sort of veered off into a Neil Wilbon throwdown around whether or not analytics had merit in and of themselves. But I think there was still a lot to discuss around sort of this very provocative thesis that Wilbon put forth, maybe without very much evidence for it, which was that analytics are a gated community for white fans to talk about sports in the way that they want to talk about it, and that it's not an inclusive way to talk about sports. So, and since we've talked to Wilbon, there's been a lot of conversation that's followed, with many African Americans taking issue with Wilbon's claim. And one of those who critiqued the piece was Chris Herring of the Wall Street Journal. And Chris is here with us now. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So what was your reaction when you read the piece?
I mean, I was actually really interested to read it when I saw the tweets pop up about it. But, you know, as soon as I started reading it, I was kind of like, oh, you know, I've essentially heard this sort of thing before, not so much from a racial standpoint, but just in terms of someone who's a critic of analytics or kind of has their own biases in terms of why analytics aren't necessary or why they don't really work as well as they should in reaching certain audiences. And so I just, you know, my main takeaway from the piece is that it seemed like it was a little bit of a confirmation bias on Mike's part. And I like Mike, I respect him. I've met him a few times and I've told him that I look up to him as a journalist. I'm from Chicago, where he spent a lot of time and where he went to school. And I think a lot of journalists would like to kind of emulate his career. And I think I probably fall into that category as well. But I didn't agree with the piece just because I don't think in any way that analytics is kind of biased racially. But I think most people that you talk to, if you kind of hit them with certain numbers, would kind of look at you cross-eyed and not understand what you're talking about. So I thought it was a little bit too much of a generalization about race. And I think that there were some ideas and theories that Mike kind of had in his head that he was able to find one, maybe two people that agreed with the premise and kind of painted that as a complete story or column.
Well, Chris, I'm wondering because when we talked about the criticism about analytics in the last year or so, I always go back to this Brian Curtis piece on Grantland that talked about a lot of the pushback he felt was this fight over who was telling the story of sports. And I'm wondering if you know, your assessment of the Wilbon piece, and as you look at the pushback on analytics, even like guys like Charles Barkley, sometimes it can seem like the common thread is people who either were athletes or were part of the storytelling of sports now had like a small piece of it was shifted with the introduction of analytics because it was a new way to tell the story of sports. Do you feel like that plays any part at all about a lot of the pushback? And now I'm not just talking racially, but I'm just talking in general about the pushback to analytics.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the most interesting things about it is this idea that you can kind of tell an entire story without ever walking into a locker room. And that's the biggest criticism, I think, of people that critique analytics in general is that they say, you know, these are people that don't watch the games, that don't ever set foot in the locker room. And it's kind of like, I'm trying to think of the best example. A lot of times columnists in general get criticized. A big one, I remember when I lived in Chicago again, Ozzie Guillen would always criticize the hell out of Jay Mariotti because he said that guy never sets foot in my clubhouse. And so how can you criticize the game and this team when you're never here and you're basically not man enough to set foot in the locker room that you're criticizing? And so there's always that idea that, you know, that you can't be fully respected if you're not spending time around the game and in front of the players and talking to the players. And, you know, I whatever stance people take on that particular issue is one thing, but I do think it's really important. If you're going to use numbers and analytics, you need to be watching the games. You need to be talking to players. And I know I've been, you know, asked to think about considering jobs at other places. And when I negotiate with them, a lot of them have said, we love the way you use numbers. And, you know, one of the things we'd do if we brought you on here, we wouldn't necessarily need you or want you to go into the locker rooms as much and to go to quite as many games. You could probably do a lot of your work remotely. And while that might be appealing to some people, I don't want to work remotely a lot of the time because I think there's so much value added in being able to get the perspective of the people that you're writing about and that you're talking about. because yeah, they understand a lot of elements of basketball better than I do. I don't think I'm necessarily a pro athlete when it comes to how well I understand certain concepts, or, you know, I read about the Knicks and the triangle offense. Yes, I understand that Phil Jackson is going to understand the triangle better than I do. So I don't want to just make blanket assumptions and put numbers to everything without having watched them play or without having talked to the players about what it's like to play in that system and what things it impacts. So, yeah, I think Charles Barkley and a lot of those people probably do feel that people are using analytics to just completely replace everything else. And if you do that, and if people do that, it is doing a disservice, because you can't really ever tell an entire story without getting the perspective of the people you're writing about, as well as watching or really researching what it is that you're writing about as well. So it should be kind of a three-prong approach in terms of watching the stuff, talking to the people involved, and then being able to rely on numbers to kind of confirm or deny whatever it is that you think might be the case.
And another thing in reading Wilmont's piece that really struck me was this concept that he was trying to convey, that, you know, Black people are interested in the emotions around sports, which immediately reminded me of market research and stories and kind of the stereotype I read all of the time about female sports fans, that female sports fans, they only want the human interest stories behind sports. And now whenever I read that about women, I kind of cringe, because, and not because it might not empirically be true in market research that, you know, I know we've actually done, but because it kind of seems like it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I think that, you know, I'm a big believer that media should be not just reacting to what we think people want, but to be setting the trend about delivering new information in new ways. Now, when you read the general concept of, like, Black people are interested in, you know, the emotions of sports as compared to the analytics, do you have the same, like, I guess, what is your overall reaction?
Well, I would agree with a lot of that. I think nobody ever goes into any sort of barbershop or salon or anywhere and talks about the nitty gritty of, you know, did you see how many points per possession that they're scoring in, you know, in this series or anything like that. Of course, no one talks like that. But in general, when I talk to my friends, I don't talk that way because they don't care. And so I don't expect the average person to care. I don't expect the average Black person to care. I just thought within that, I don't think the average person of any race or gender or age cares with regards to that sort of thing. So I just thought it was really odd that he picked out Black people. I mean, obviously, Will Don is Black. I am too. And so we've had that shared experience at the barbershop, but every conversation that you have in a barbershop is kind of just surface level, where you don't really dig beneath the surface, whether you're talking about women, whether you're talking about basketball, whether you're talking about life. It's one of those things where when you ask someone how they are, you don't actually want to dig into it. You're asking them as a courtesy, and you're getting into it as a courtesy, but you don't actually want to dig beneath the surface and actually hear about how their day was. So I just thought it was really odd that he kind of picked out that demographic. And specifically, you know, when he did talk about the emotions and kind of the way certain people play and not caring about their numbers, and he quoted Draymond Green in the piece, you know, for every person that's like Draymond Green that doesn't care about their numbers, I thought it was ironic for two reasons. One, a lot of players do care about their numbers. Kevin Durant had an analytics coach. LeBron is very, very aware of certain things like that. And the guy that Durant used as an analytics coach, now Rajon Rondo uses that person, John Wall uses that person, Paul George has gotten more into that conversation as well. And so a lot of people do care about analytics. One, two, Draymond, you know, the same guy that was shown on video in terms of being able to list all 34 people that were drafted ahead of him on ESPN, if analytics had been used more in his case with regards to his draft positioning, he probably would have gone a lot higher, because he kind of jumped off the charts in terms of all the intangibles that he had. A lot of intangibles that, one, you can see with the kind of heart he plays with and the grit and, you know, some people would say kind of the dirty way that he plays the game. But it also was kind of bearing that out in numbers numerically before he even came out of Michigan State. So, I just find it ironic that he kind of picked one athlete to quote there when there are a lot that do really value the idea of analytics. But just more generally, again, I don't think that any race of people has any sort of, you know, that they just cringe when they hear a number. I think that's just true of our society in general.
And Chris, do you think that almost this is, as much as anything, indicative of us in the media? Kind of, we focus a lot on analytics, and you know, us here on this show especially kind of talk about it a lot. But that it's not as much in the conversation of just everyday fandom as maybe we think, because we talk about it a lot in the media and think about it. Whether people are like Wilbon and kind of opposed to it, or people more like us who are kind of into it.
You know, I don't know that anyone is really, I guess there are people that are into it. And again, I guess, you know, it may be because it's presented in the media, it's kind of more important to us in terms of how it's presented. But a lot of times I see people on Twitter praising broadcast teams and television networks when they show, you know, a per 100 possession statistic instead of points per game. I think a lot of this stuff, you know, maybe to Wilbon's displeasure and a lot of other people, a lot of this stuff is going to become more mainstream in the next few years, the same way that, you know, a lot of numbers that we didn't use before, now we do, that have become really standard in baseball and basketball. And I think, you know, when you really pare it down and boil it down, a lot of it is way more basic than people make it out to be. I don't think it's as exclusive as a lot of people make it out to be. You know, I hated math in school. I took one math class at the University of Michigan, because I wanted to avoid math because I wasn't good at it. I'm still not good at it. I'm not by any means someone that creates new statistics and stuff. I might look at some new things, but I think more than anything, analytics is a way of asking interesting questions and trying to find out an answer to them, which can kind of help prove or disprove a premise.
I want to get to the last point that Wilbon made in his article, which was that there was a possibility that that analytics would sort of become a new gated community within front offices because it was a predominantly white practice for those who are maybe making some new stats, or maybe for those who are making decisions in front offices or advocating for certain decisions in front offices. And I wonder, Chris, in your reporting around the league, have you seen that be the case, that it is a predominantly white enterprise thus far, and maybe as a result we aren't getting the kind of diversity of thought that maybe is needed within any sport in order to thrive?
Well, I think, you know, to be honest with you, that was an interesting point. I've heard that point before. I don't think it was a completely original thought in that story. And the NBA is kind of cognizant of that perception too. I was at a meeting a couple weeks ago with Adam Silver and a number of other reporters from bigger newspapers or outlets here in New York. And he was asked that question about the diversity around the league and making sure that the diversity in the league itself, or at least the way that the league looks, where, you know, it's about 75% black, why don't the coaching ranks kind of mirror that a little bit better? And, you know, in terms of front offices, why doesn't it look more that way? And, you know, he did say that, you know, league wide, not necessarily black players or anyone else, but just people in general that have been around the game, basically that the league has set up training for people to kind of understand some of these things better. Because, you know, I don't think the league was as numbers friendly before, or if it was, it wasn't, there wasn't as high a threshold in terms of the certain types of numbers that were being used. And so the league is trying to kind of make sure that people have the knowledge that they need, just a basic working knowledge of some of these numbers and these stats and kind of what to look at. And so I do think there might have been a valid point there. Howard Beck did a great story for Bleacher Report toward the beginning of the season or last summer, I think, about how the number of black coaches has declined. And there wasn't really a strong correlation to anything in the story. He wasn't able to really say definitively why that was. But I do think it's worth looking at, you know, to see if there is some tie to that. I don't necessarily think that it's an analytics sort of thing. You know, there are a lot of GMs and coaches that don't really study the analytics all that closely. You know, Larry Bird does not strike me as someone that would pay a ton of attention to analytics, and he hired Nate McMillan. And so, you know, I think that there are still plenty of opportunities out there for people that don't really subscribe to the idea of analytics. But it is something that you would want people to have at least a basic working knowledge of, just so that they aren't held out of a possible opportunity for them because they don't understand how they work.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, as an editor within journalism, I think one of the reasons you want a diverse writing staff is so that you can have a diversity of ideas and thought, obviously. And so I do wonder if analytics are seen as sort of a space for not for all, but only for some, whether that actually leads to obviously further less development of new ideas than would be the case otherwise, because everyone is coming from a similar viewpoint about what may be important or what may not.
I think if you focus on any one element of anything too much, it's bad. I think if you are a complete field person that doesn't believe at all and looking at the numbers to at least see how they look, you're going to miss certain opportunities. You know, looking at lineup data, for instance, I guess analytics are involved in that just to see how certain things look in terms of, you know, when you put the death lineup out there for Golden State, does that lineup do well? Obviously, we've seen it's dominated throughout the league for like the last year, year and a half. But without lineup data, you know, you wouldn't know to try that after a couple games to start trying that more, or you might not know to try that, and you might not pick that up just based on a feel. It's not normal to look out there and see five guys that are 6'7" or shorter dominate the NBA, you know, so a lot of people would not think that that would work. And so lineup data might help you uncover that sort of thing more quickly. You can't go completely off feel in the same way you can't necessarily go completely off numbers because of sample sizes and things like that. And you can't go completely off of the numbers and the feel because you have players that obviously need to tell you how it makes them feel. Does it wear them down too much to play in those certain types of lineups? Paul George said repeatedly that he didn't like playing power forward. LeBron has kind of grumbled before about playing some of the big positions. And I know, having covered Carmelo, that he's not a huge, huge fan of playing down in the post for entire games. And so you need all three parts of that information to really be able to make an informed decision. And so if you're leaving part of that out, you know, I think it would bore people to just read numbers all day long in terms of fans and the people that read my work. It would probably put you in a pretty bad spot too if you were an organization and you only relied on numbers and not using your scouts, or if you only use your scouts and not your numbers, or if you never had dialogues with your players. So yeah, there is a fear, a little bit of a fear that, you know, maybe the league gets too carried away with analytics, but I would tend to think that as long as you've got scouts and as long as you've got coaches that need to speak with their players, you're not going to really have any one part that's relied on too heavily, I would think.
All right, Chris Herring, thanks very much for coming on Hot Takedown.
Oh, no problem at all. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Listeners, you can read more of Chris's work at the Wall Street Journal. All right, Kate had to jump off to attend to other business, but Neil and I are here to talk about hockey.
With another Neil.
The Stanley Cup Finals are here. The Pittsburgh Penguins and the San Jose Sharks are going at one another on the ice. The Penguins are already up one game to Love. Am I mixing my sports here, Neil? Do I have it right?
Yeah, no, I think Love is the wrong sport. Oh. Kevin Love, maybe? I don't know if that works.
But Neil Greenberg of the Washington Post is here to talk us through it. Neil, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Neil, for those of us who have not necessarily been keeping up with hockey since you last appeared on Hot Takedown, we always talk about whether luck is a factor when it comes to the hockey playoffs. Have the Penguins and the Sharks gotten to the finals by luck or by merit?
Well, it's a little bit of both. There's been a number of studies in hockey that show goal scoring can be as much as 70% luck, depending on where the shot originates from. So you need both to get in. I made an argument in the Pittsburgh Penguins-Washington Capitals series that the Capitals had played better than Pittsburgh, but Pittsburgh got more of the puck luck and thus advanced. I think there were plenty of times when the Capitals were driving puck possession better on Pittsburgh. But as I said, you need a little bit of both. The Penguins got the timely goals and they've moved on. And I think what we're seeing now is a team like the Pittsburgh Penguins, who rank third in what we call adjusted Corsi. So after you adjust their puck possession for score effects, they were the third best team in the league, which historically has meant Stanley Cup success, versus the San Jose Sharks, which ranked 10th. The Sharks are a good team. They have a lot of good things going for them. But I think that if we're looking at who's the better skilled team, it's probably Pittsburgh Penguins by more than people want to give them credit for.
Now, is there something to this where obviously the Penguins have done this before, maybe not super recently, but I think to casual observers, you kind of see Crosby and you see some of the other players that they have and you think, oh, this is a team with a pedigree. Whereas, especially in the West Final, either one of those two teams that ended up being San Jose that prevailed, those were teams that were known as kind of chokers, for lack of a better term, that they had never kind of been in this stage. And so now that you have San Jose in the final, finally, after years of being one of these teams that always seem to have good regular seasons and then kind of flame out, is there something to be said for an experience differential there, or some kind of, you know, pedigree there? Our colleague Ben Morris has this in basketball where he says, you know, even after controlling for how good the teams kind of have played during the season, the team that has the championship pedigree is the team that usually wins. Is that true in hockey also?
I don't think so. You're absolutely right, though, about the San Jose Sharks, and I'd even probably throw the Vancouver Canucks in there as the two perennial, quote-unquote, cup favorites that come out of the West usually before the season starts. You know, and as you mentioned, the Sharks certainly have had their fair share of regular season success. Where it differs from basketball is, you know, you look at a guy like Russell Westbrook, who plays, 30 minutes, 35 minutes a night, mm-hmm. whereas the best hockey players only play 15 to 20 minutes a night, and that's really also dependent on how much power play time they get. So when you look at just even strength, perhaps they're playing 15, 18 minutes a night, and those come in 45 to 1 minute chunks, right, in shifts. So it's much more difficult for a superstar, or even for a team that has a good pedigree, to make a tremendous amount of impact, only because they're not on the ice as often as we see in basketball. However, you know, there's certainly something to what we're seeing in both San Jose with Joe Thornton and Patrick Marleau, and even Logan Couture to some extent, and then also on Pittsburgh with Crosby and Malkin. And then you can even add Phil Kessel in there, who, you know, there are very few people who think that Phil Kessel has a quote-unquote championship pedigree, but he's been one of the most dominating scorers in the NHL for quite some time and has just got a bad rap because he doesn't look like an athlete, but he's still every bit as good as some of the other superstars that we see. So I just think that we're seeing some really good teams, Pittsburgh especially, and you know, I'm not surprised necessarily that both teams are where they are. I'm probably a little bit more surprised about San Jose, because I myself preferred Chicago in terms of being able to drive play and have the skilled players to put pucks in the net. But you know, as we saw, they were beaten pretty early.
And you say that, but San Jose has won 8 games by at least 3 goals this postseason. Only 5 teams in NHL history have won more by that margin. So it seems as though they've been especially strong, maybe so strong that we should reevaluate our thinking on them. And on top of that, Joe Pavelski just seems like he's going to be a star on the level of Ovechkin if he keeps this up.
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, Pavelski is certainly in the Conn Smythe conversation for MVP of the playoffs, but there is no other player like Alex Ovechkin. I mean, there's no one that's even close, not even Sidney Crosby in terms of scoring. And when you look at the prototypical power forwards, it's really only Alex Ovechkin. When you look at a player that both scores and hits, you know, there's Alex Ovechkin, and then there's a huge gap, and then there's everybody else. But you know, Pavelski and Thornton and Couture, they and even Brett Burns, I would say, who's a defenseman but plays more like a forward. You know, they provide an element that we don't see much of in the NHL, especially on the power play, where you have 4 or 5 guys on the ice that are all tremendous scorers. I mean, you're talking about four players that were in the top 10, top 15, top 20 of scoring this season. So that's what makes them dangerous. However, as we saw in Game 1, Pittsburgh's speed is the great neutralizer, because they're able to get through the neutral zone quickly. They're able to set up quickly. They're able to do all these things that you want a hockey team to do. And, by the way, they have the best player in the world in Sidney Crosby, and have all these other components that make them a tough team.
So since you mentioned the Conn Smythe, who are we looking at here as kind of the favorite for it right now? Usually try to look at the goalies, is that right? And it seems like the hottest goalie kind of tends to carry whoever ends up winning the Stanley Cup. But is that true this year? The Penguins are rolling with a guy that wasn't even their starter for a lot of the year.
Yeah, I don't think that we're going to see one of the goaltenders win the Conn Smythe this year. I think it's Pavelski if the San Jose Sharks win. I think it's probably Phil Kessel if Pittsburgh wins, unless Sidney Crosby gets one of the game winners or two and then ends up really, really making his presence felt in this series. We didn't really see him that much in the Washington series. There was he wasn't really contributing in the scoring sheet as we're used to seeing Crosby. So I think that if he starts to get a one or two timely goals that tilts the series, that's enough because of his gravitas to swing it in his favor. But right now I'd say the two front runners are probably Pavelski and Kessel on Pittsburgh.
All right, Neil, usually, you know, we end a segment like this by giving 538's prediction about who's going to win the series. 538 has no
hockey ELO
forecast
model.
So we will rely upon your expertise. Pittsburgh is already up one game. It sounds like, especially given that you think they're going to close this thing out one way or another.
I do. They were my pre-playoff pick to win the Stanley Cup. So I'm going to stick with them. I think this could be a relatively short series. It wouldn't surprise me to see Pittsburgh win in five, but I think it's probably going to go six with Pittsburgh coming out on top.
All right, Neil Greenberg. People can read your work at the Washington Post and your Fancy Stats blog. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, guys.
And now, the part of our show, and telling number from the world of sports, is brought to our doorstep. Kate is still out, but Joe Sykes is in, our producer, our immortal, our estimable producer, not our erstwhile producer, Joe Sykes. Joe, what do you have for us?
Hey, Chad. So, soccer as usual. The Sig Dig...
Pause for laughter, Joe.
The Sig Dig this week is 17 years and 253 days. That's the age of Christian Pulisic when he became the youngest player ever to score a goal in U.S. men's national team history against Bolivia at the weekend.
That's a wee pup, as you would say in England.
That is very young. He's not, however, in the history of international soccer, he's nowhere near the top. He's not even in the top 100 of the youngest players. In fact, according to the Soccer Statistics Foundation, that accolade goes to Ang Kiao Tun, may have butchered his name there, from Myanmar, who was 14 years and 93 days when he scored against Thailand in 2000.
Wow.
So that's young.
14.
Wow.
What were you doing at 14, Chad?
Dreaming of the sports podcast.
Chad was writing about Lost, probably, at the age of...
So... This, you know, in baseball, we just saw a 19-year-old Julio Urias pitch for the Dodgers on Friday night against, yes,
you physically saw it. You saw it in person.
But maybe we're in a youth movement moment. You know, here's two examples, therefore, a trend.
And Pulisic is, you know...
wildly different sports, two examples.
The U.S. has a history of sort of holding these young players up. Tony Chow... who's our man in the control room, he said, please don't do this because you'll be jinxing Pulisic because of...
Oh, by mentioning Freddie Adu.
Well, Freddie Adu is the one who comes to mind, the sort of superstar 14-year-old who is now, unfortunately, playing for the Tampa Bay Rowdies in the North American Soccer League.
So my question with Adu has always been, and we could probably devote like whole segments to this, but was it the case that he had the potential to become great and just didn't capitalize on it, or was he overrated almost specifically because he was like the American hope as a youngster, and he never was actually going to be as good as people were hyping him to be.
I think it was just there was no American superstar, and suddenly this kid comes along and everyone's praising him and everyone's picking him on, you know, soccer fantasy games and
FIFA.
Right, exactly. And, you know, it never worked out.
So does that doom this kid also, or do we have reason to think that the U.S. program is stronger now that perhaps, you know, it's capable of producing a world-class talent?
Well, I'm not sure about that, but he is, you know, right now he is about to be tested because the Copa America is coming up, held in the USA, and, you know, he's in the squad, looks like he might even get a starting place, so... It'll be exciting to watch over the next few weeks.
Well, if he doesn't score, he's a bum, and we'll run him out of the country.
Thanks for that, Neil.
All right. Glad this conversation went to such a constructive place.
You should hear our Mets podcast.
That's true.
Lots of talk like that.
You want to give it the name, Neil?
It's called Panic City.
Nicely done. See? Nicely
I have done. To listen to it every week.
Joe Sykes, thanks for delivering our significant digit.
No problem, Chad.
You want to stay in person so I can thank you in person during the credits?
I'll stay in person, yeah.
All right, great. Thanks to Kate Fagan in absentia for coming on the show. Neil Payne, thanks very much.
You are welcome, Chad.
Our podcast producer, still in the studio, still looking dapper, is Joe Sykes. Our podcast overlord is Jody Avergan. We got production assistance from Tony Chow and Jonathan Yales. Thanks to you both. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. You can find us on your favorite podcasting app. We're also on iTunes. Subscribe at iTunes.com/538. Be sure to review and or rate the show. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.